And a moment later, there is a mighty crack and a groan, and the Klausu shudders as if it just got hit by a 5-er tsunami. Cyanite looks up in time to see the mast shatter into kindling. And then everything goes wrong. The mast creaks and goes over like a felled tree, and it hits the deck with the same force. People scream. The ship groans and begins to list starboard, pulled by the collapsed, dragging sails. She sees two men fall into the water with the sails, crushed or smothered by the weight of cloth and rope and wood. And, Earth help her, she cannot think of them. The mast is between her and the pilot deck. She's cut off from Inan and Koru. And the Guardian's ship is now closing in. No! Cyanite reaches for the water, trying to pull something, anything, into her abused Sesapine. But there's nothing. Her mind is as still as glass. The Guardians are too close. She can't think. She scrabbles over the mast parts, gets tangled in a thicket of ropes, and must fight for endless hours, it feels like, to get free. Then finally she is free, but everyone's running back the way she came, glass knives and javelins in hand, shouting and screaming, because the Guardian ship is right there, and they are boarding. No. She can hear people dying all around her. The Guardians have brought troops of some sort with them, some comms militia that they've paid or appropriated, and the battle isn't even close. Inan's people are good, experienced, but their usual targets are poorly defended merchant and passenger vessels. As Cyanite reaches the pilot deck, Inan isn't there. He must have gone below. She sees Inan's cousin Acela slash a militiaman across the face with her glass knife. He staggers beneath the blow, but then comes back up and shoves his own knife into her belly. When she falls, he pushes her away, and she falls onto the body of another Meovite, who is already dead. More of the troops are climbing aboard by the minute. It's the same everywhere. They're losing. She has to get to Inan and Koru. Below decks, there's almost no one there. Everyone has come up to defend the ship. But she can feel the tremor that is Koru's fear, and she follows it to Inan's cabin. The door opens as she reaches it, and Inan comes out with a knife in his hand, nearly stabbing her. He stops, startled, and she looks beyond him to see that Koru has been bundled into a basket beneath the forward bulkhead, the safest place in the ship, ostensibly. But as she stands there, stupidly, Inan grabs her and shoves her into the cabin. What?
Stay here, Inan says. I have to go fight. Do whatever you have.
He gets no further. Someone moves behind him, too quick for Cyanite to cry a warning. A man, naked to the waist. He claps hands onto either side of Inan's head, fingers splayed across his cheeks like spiders, and grins at Cyanite as Inan's eyes widen. And then it is... Oh, Earth, it is... She feels it when it happens. Not just in her Sesapine. It is a grind like stone abrading her skin. It is a crush along her bones. It is everything that is in Inan, all the power and vibrancy and beauty and fierceness of him. Made evil. Amplified and concentrated and turned back on him in the most vicious way. Inan does not have time to feel fear. Cyanite does not have time to scream as Inan comes apart. It's like watching a shake-up close, seeing the ground split, watching the fragments grind and splinter together, then separate. Except all in flesh.
Bastard, you never told me. You didn't tell me it was like...
Now Inan is on the floor in a pile. The Guardian who has killed him stands there, splattered in blood and grinning through it.
Ah, little one,
says a voice, and her blood turns to stone.
Here you are.
No, she whispers.
She shakes her head in denial, steps backward. Koru is crying. She steps back again and stumbles against Inan's bed, fumbles for the basket, pulls Koru into her arms. He clings to her, shaking and hitching fitfully.
No.
The shirtless guardian glances to one side. Then he moves aside to make room for another to enter.
No.
There's no need for these histrionics, Tamaya,
Shafa Guardian Warrant says softly. Then he pauses, looks apologetic.
Cyanide?
She has not seen him in years, but his voice is the same. His face is the same. He never changes. He's even smiling, though it fades a little in distaste as he notices the mess that was Inan. He glances at the shirtless guardian, the man still grinning. Shafa sighs, but smiles in return. Then they both turn those horrible, horrible smiles on Cyanide. She cannot go back. She will not go back.
And what is this?
Shafa smiles, his gaze fixing on Koru in her arms.
How lovely. Alabasters? Does he live too? We would all like to see Alabaster, Cyanide. Where is he?
The habit of answering is too deep. The Stone Eater took him. Her voice shakes. She steps back again, and her head presses against the bulkhead. There's nowhere left to run. For the first time since she's ever known him, Shafa blinks and looks surprised.
Stone, hmm?
He sobers.
I see. We should have killed him, then, before they got to him. As a kindness, of course. You cannot imagine what they will do to him, Cyanide.
Alas. Then Shafa smiles again, and she remembers everything she's tried to forget. She feels alone again, and helpless as she was that day near Palella, lost in the hateful world, with no one to rely on except a man whose love comes wrapped in pain.
But his child will be a more than worthwhile replacement, Shafa says.
There are moments when everything changes, you understand? Koru's wailing, terrified, and perhaps he even understands somehow what has happened to his father's. Cyanide cannot console him.
No, she says again. No, no, no.
Shafa's smile fades.
Cyanide, I told you, never say no to me.
Even the hardest stone can fracture. It just takes the right force, applied at the right juncture of angles, a fulcrum of pressure and weakness.
Promise, Alabaster had said. Do whatever you have to, Inan had tried to say.
And Cyanide says,
No, you fucker!
Koru is crying. She puts her hand over his mouth and nose to silence him, to comfort him. She will keep him safe. She will not let them take him, enslave him, turn his body into a tool and his mind into a weapon, and his life into a travesty of freedom.
You understand these moments, I think, instinctively. It is our nature. We are born of such pressures. And sometimes, when things are unbearable.
Shafa stops.
Cyanide, that's not my rusting name. I'll say no to you all I want, you bastard.
She's screaming the words. Spittle froths her lips. There's a dark, heavy space inside her that is heavier than the Stone Eater. Much heavier than a mountain. And it's eating everything else like a sinkhole. Everyone she loves is dead. Everyone except Koru. And if they take him?
Sometimes, even, we crack.
Better that a child never have lived at all than live as a slave. Better that he die. Better that she die. Alabaster will hate her for this, for leaving him alone. But Alabaster is not here. And survival is not the same thing as living. So she reaches up, out. The amethyst is there, above, waiting with the patience of the dead, as if it somehow knew this moment would come. She reaches for it now, and prays that Alabaster was right about the thing being too much for her to handle. And as her awareness dissolves amid jewel-toned light and faceted ripples, Ashafa gasps in realization and lunges for her, as Koru's eyes flutter shut over her pressing, smothering hand. She opens herself to all the power of the ancient unknown, and tears the world apart. Here is the stillness. Here is a place off its eastern coast, a bit south of the equator. There is an island here, one of a chain of precarious little land slabs that rarely last longer than a few hundred years. This one's been around for several thousand, in testament to the wisdom of its inhabitants. This is the moment when that island dies, but at least a few of those inhabitants should survive to go elsewhere. Perhaps that will make you feel better. The purple obelisk that hovers above it pulses once with a great throb of power that would be familiar to anyone who'd been in the late calm called Alia on the day of its death. As this pulse fades, the ocean below heaves as its rocky floor convulses. Spikes, wet and knife-like, burst up from the waves and utterly shatter the ships that float near the island's shores. A number of the people aboard each, some pirates, some their enemies, are speared through. So great is the thicket of death around them. This convulsion spreads away from the island in a long, wending ripple, forming a chain of jagged, terrible spears from Mayov's harbor all the way to what is left of Alia. A land bridge. Not the sort anyone would much want to cross, but nevertheless. When all the death is done and the obelisk is calm, only a handful of people are still alive in the ocean below. One of them, a woman, floats unconscious amid the debris of her shattered ship. Not far from her, a smaller figure, a child, floats too, but face down. Her fellow survivors will find her and take her to the mainland. There she will wander, lost and losing herself for 2 long years. But not alone. For that is when I found her, you see. The moment of the obelisk's pulse was the moment in which her presence sang across the world. A promise, a demand, an invitation too enticing to resist. Many of us converged on her then. But I am the one who found her first. I fought off the others and trailed her, watched her, guarded her. I was glad when she found the little town called Terimo, and comfort, if not happiness, for a time. I introduced myself to her eventually, finally, 10 years later, as she left Terimo. It's not the way we usually do these things, of course. It is not the relationship with her kind that we normally seek. But she is. Was special. You were. Are. Special. I told her that I was called Hoa. It is as good a name as any. This is how it began. Listen. Learn. This is how the world changed. 23. You're all you need. There's a structure in Kastrima that glitters. It's on the lowermost level of the great geode, and you think it must have been built rather than grown. Its walls aren't carved solid crystal, but slabs of quarried white mica, flecked delicately with infinitesimal crystal flakes that are no less beautiful than their larger cousins, if not as dramatic. Why someone would carry these slabs here and Make a house out of them amid all these ready-made, uninhabited apartments. You have no idea. You don't ask. You don't care. Lerna comes with you because this is the comm's official infirmary, and the man you're coming to see is his patient. But you stop him at the door, and there's something in your face that must warn him of the danger. He does not protest when you go in without him. You walk through its open doorway slowly, and stop when you spy the Stone Eater across the infirmary's large main room. Antimony, yes. You'd almost forgotten the name Alabaster gave her. She looks back at you impassively, hardly distinguishable from the white wall, save for the rust of her fingertips and the stark black of her hair and eyes. She hasn't changed since the last time you saw her, 12 years ago, at the end of Mayoff. But then, for her kind, 12 years is nothing. You nod to her anyway. It's the polite thing to do, and there's still a little left of you that's the woman the fulcrum raised. You can be polite to anybody, no matter how much you hate them. She says, "No closer." She's not talking to you. You turn, unsurprised, to see that Hoa is behind you. Where'd he come from? He's just as still as Antimony, unnaturally still, which makes you finally notice that he doesn't breathe. He never has, in all the time you've known him. How the rust did you miss that? Hoa watches her, with the same steady glower of threat that he offered to Yiko's Stone Eater. Perhaps none of them like each other. Must make reunions awkward. "I'm not interested in him," Hoa says. Antimony's eyes shift over to you for a moment. Then her gaze returns to Hoa. "I am interested in her only on his behalf." Hoa says nothing. Perhaps he's considering this. Perhaps it's an offer of truce or a staking of claims. You shake your head and walk past them both. At the back of the main room, on a pile of cushions and blankets, lies a thin black figure, wheezing. It stirs a little, lifting its head slowly as you approach. As you crouch just out of his arm's reach, you're relieved to recognize him. Everything else has changed, but his eyes at least are the same.
"Sutton," he says. His voice is thick gravel.
"Asun now," you say automatically. He nods. This seems to cause him pain. For a moment, his eyes squint shut. Then he draws in another breath, makes a visible effort to relax, and revives somewhat.
"I knew you weren't dead."
"Why didn't you come then?" you say.
"Had my own problems to deal with."
He smiles a little. You actually hear the skin on the left side of his face. There's a big burned patch there, crinkle. His eyes shift over to Antimony, as slowly as a Stone Eater's movements. Then he returns his attention to you. To her, Cyanite.
To you, Esun.
Rusted. You'll be glad when you finally figure out who you really are.
"And I've been busy."
Now Alabaster lifts his right arm. It ends, abruptly, in the middle of the forearm. He's not wearing anything on his upper body, so you can clearly see what's happened. There's not much left of him. He's missing a lot of pieces, and he stinks of blood and pus and urine and cooked meat. The arm injury, though, is not one he earned from Eumenus's fires, or at least not directly. The stump of his arm is capped with something hard and brown that is definitely not skin. Too hard. Too uniformly chalk-like in its visible composition. Stone. His arm has become stone. Most of it's gone, though, in the stump. Tooth marks. Those are tooth marks. You glance up at Antimony again and think of a diamond smile.
"Here you've been busy, too," Baster says.
You nod, finally dragging your gaze away from the Stone Eater. "Now you know what kind of stone they eat. After Mayoff, I was... You're not sure how to say it. There are griefs too deep to be borne, and yet you have borne them again and again. I needed to be different.
It makes no sense.
Alabaster makes a soft affirmative sound, though, as if he understands.
You stayed free, at least.
If hiding everything you are is free, yes.
Settled down?
Got married. Had two children.
Alabaster is silent. With all the patches of char and chalky brown stone on his face, you can't tell if he's smiling or scowling. You assume the latter, though, so you add.
Both of them were, like me. I'm... my husband...
Words make things real in a way that even memories can't, so you stop there.
I understand why you killed Corundum, Alabaster says very softly.
And then, while you sway in your crouch, literally reeling from the blow of that sentence, he finishes you.
But I'll never forgive you for doing it.
Damn. Damn him. Damn yourself.
It takes you a moment to respond.
I understand if you want to kill me, you manage at last.
Then you lick your lips, swallow, spit the words out.
But I have to kill my husband first.
Alabaster lets out a wheezing sigh.
Your other two kids.
You nod. Doesn't matter that Nasun's alive in this instance. Jija took her from you. That is insult enough.
I'm not going to kill you, Sai. Esun.
He sounds tired. Maybe he doesn't hear the little sound you make, which is neither relief nor disappointment.
I wouldn't, even if I could.
If you...
can you do it yet?
He rides over your confusion the way he always did. Nothing about him has changed, except his ruined body.
You drew on the garnet at Alia, but that one was half-dead. You must have used the amethyst at Mayov, but that was... an extremity. Can you do it at will now?
I... you don't want to understand. But now your eyes are drawn away from the horror that remains of your mentor, your lover, your friend.
To the side and behind Alabaster, where a strange object rests against the wall of the infirmary. It looks like a glass knife, but the blade is much too long and wide for practical use. It has an enormous handle, perhaps because the blade is so stupidly long, and a crosspiece that will get in the way the first time someone tries to use the thing to cut meat or slice through a knot. And it's not made of glass, or at least not any glass you've ever seen. It's pink, verging on red, and you stare at it. Into it. You feel it trying to draw your mind in, down, falling up, through an endless shaft of flickering, faceted pink light. You gasp and twitch back into yourself defensively, then stare at Alabaster. He smiles again, painfully.
The spinel,
he says, confirming your shock.
That one's mine. Have you made any of them yours yet? Do the obelisks come when you call?
You don't want to understand, but you do. You don't want to believe. But really, you have all along.
You tore that rift up north, you breathe. Your hands are clenching into fists.
You split the continent. You started the season with the obelisks. You did. All of that.
Yes, with the obelisks, and with the aid of the node maintainers. They are all at peace now.
He exhales wheezily.
I need your help.
You shake your head automatically, but not in refusal.
To fix it?
Oh no, Cyan.
You don't even bother to correct him this time. You can't take your eyes from his amused, nearly skeletal face. When he speaks, you notice that some of his teeth have turned to stone, too. How many of his organs have done the same? How much longer can he, should he, live like this?
I don't want you to fix it,
Alabaster says.
It was collateral damage, but Eumenes got what it deserved. No, what I want you to do, my Demaya, my Cyanite, my Esun, is make it worse.
You stare at him, speechless. Then he leans forward. That this is painful for him is obvious. You hear the creak and stretch of his flesh, and a faint crack, as some piece of stone somewhere on him fissures. But when he is close enough, he grins again, and suddenly it hits you. Evil eating Earth, he's not crazy at all. And he never has been.
Tell me, he says, have you ever heard of something called a moon?
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Fifth Season, The Broken Earth, Book 1. Written by N.K. Jennison, read by Robin Miles. Produced and directed by Tommy Harron. Post-production by Gabino Reyes. The Fifth Season is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by N.K. Jemison. Audio production copyright 2015, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.